His mission is to change the world, to make a difference by developing the next generation of world environmental leaders. And we talk a lot here at Antioch Awakens. We think a lot here about how that happens. And one of the things I talk about is the multiplier effect of the work of an institution like Antioch University New England. Students come through the doors behind you to start graduate work here. A few years later, they walk out those doors, transformed people. But the real, and we are very proud of the difference we make here, but the real effect of our work takes place later, we believe, in that each of these individuals then goes into the world and into their own spheres of influence make a very big difference in the future of this planet. In a sense, that's our mission for you today. I don't know that we wrote that down anywhere, but you're now part of our multiplier effect project. So we know you'll have a tremendous learning experience here today, and we encourage you and expect that you will spread the word as you leave here and make a real difference in your own lives and in the lives of people close to you, and as that multiplier effect continues in many lives. And so enjoy your work here at the symposium today. Enjoy your time at Antioch University New England, and welcome.
Thank you, David. Morning, everybody, and I want to say thank you for coming out on this beautiful, tropical, rainy day. And I am Peter Palmiano. I am the co-director of the Center for Tropical Ecology and Conservation. And it's my pleasure to welcome you officially from the center and from the center staff. And it'll be my honor to introduce our keynote speaker, Dean Sikon. But before I do that, I'd like to introduce you to the mission of CTEC and the goals of the symposium. And the center was established by my co-director, Dr. Beth Kaplan, in 2001. And she also sends her welcome. She can't be here today. She's in Rwanda doing research. And the main goal of the center is to link New England to the tropics. And we do this by supporting our students at Antioch New England Graduate School, who do research in the tropics. And we support them providing grants and internships, outstanding advice, of course, providing them contacts and seed scholarship money. We also support students and make connections in New England through our educational program that is bringing in guest speakers, data analysis workshops, and symposia like the one you're attending today. These symposia bring together outstanding speakers from New England and the tropics to exchange information, because we're so interconnected, not only through the annual migrations of birds and whales and butterflies, but also through commerce and the daily choices we make in life, like the coffee we drink. Which brings us to why we're here today and the symposium goals. I was already there, thank you. Number one, we're gonna evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of current agricultural practices in terms of A, their ability to support ecological systems and ecosystem services, and B, their economic viability. Second goal is to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of organizations or programs dedicated to bridging the ecology and economic interface on farms in New England and in the tropics. And finally, third goal is to discuss the role that sustainable agriculture plays in community building and land stewardship in New England and the tropics. Now, to start us off in addressing these goals, we have invited Dean Sikon, founder and head of Dean's Bees. There we go, thank you. He's going to energize us with a keynote address entitled Living Your Values, How Your Personal and Professional Choices Affect Sustainability. Dean is well qualified to talk on these subjects. He's a true visionary and pioneer. By putting into practice the values and ideals, ecological and social justice ideals, offering a highly successful inspiration model for change in one of the world's most competitive exploitive industries, the production of international coffee. Using the power as a coffee roaster and distributor, Dean's Beans only purchases shade-grown organic coffee beans. The company buys directly from small-scale villages, village-based producers who grow the beans, and he guarantees independently verifiable fair trade to these farmers. Based on developing solid and healthy relationships with farming communities, Dean Beans also facilitates these communities' access to energy-efficient, appropriate technologies, and microcredit lending. Dean's company promotes local empowerment and self-reliance through their fair trade purchases and their work with local grassroots development and human rights groups. Dean's Beans is also a leader here at home, sponsoring projects in the U.S. with Native Americans, homeless, and the disabled, and many other groups trying to improve lives and that of their communities. Now, last year, the company received the best practices recognition from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and the 2004 Sustainability Award for Specialty Coffee Association. Dean himself received in 2005 the Person of the Year Award from the North Pompon Chambers of Commerce in Massachusetts, and most recently been awarded the Environmental Excellence Award from Antioch University, New England. Truly a man of many talents, Dean has a law degree from New York Law School and an advanced degree from Yale Law School. He has been a fellow at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, a senior Fulbright Scholar in New Zealand, an Ella Baker Fellow, a visiting scholar at Yale School of Law. Dean has taught environmental law, natural resource policy, international resource management, both at the University of Massachusetts and the University of Rhode Island. He has several professional publications on law, development, resource management, and indigenous peoples. Dean also performs on stage, and recently he was part of the filming crew for Pirates of the Caribbean, and look for the opening scene in Pirates of the Caribbean 3. You might recognize Dean Sycon. With that, Dean.
I hear stuff like that and I go, me? Well, I'm 53, you know, I've packed it in. So it's been a long life since I graduated Williams College in 75. And since that time I've worked or lived in 40 countries because I'm passionate about travel, I'm passionate about culture, and I'm passionate about the environment. And so what better way to live a life than to combine your passions? You know, I always had a theory that you should live where you want to live or do what you want to do. Most people aspire to get one of those if they can, and most people don't get either. But I'm very blessed in that I've been able to do the both. So if you get one thing out of today's talk, keep that in mind. Live where you want to live and do what you want to do. The rest will follow. If you follow your passion and you work hard, you'll get where you want to go and the money will follow if that's a concern. I didn't start Dean's Beans out to make $1 million. That was never my intention. I started Dean's Beans to model that a business could be a proactive and positive force in social change and environmental conservation, and at the same time be profitable, because I thought, you know, there are lots of good nonprofits out there, but the business world doesn't pay any attention to them. And since business is the greatest generator of activity on this planet and the most destructive force on this planet, until businesses change the fundamental operating principles, we will not have significant social or environmental progress. That's my belief. And so I thought, well, better way to bring my belief into reality than to model it in a business. I don't like being a businessman. I don't want to be a businessman. I don't like sitting around in business conferences. This is like home to me. However, my mission is to do what I've stated I'm doing. Oddly enough, almost 13 years later, we've got 10 full-time employees with full health care, pensions, profit sharing, and free coffee. And we have profit sharing with all our farmers. I'll get into some of the details of that. And we're going to be hitting $2.5 million in sales this year. Okay? All on the desire to do it right, not to amass a fortune. So do it right, do it with integrity, and the world will welcome you. That's what I come to after 13 years of this. What I wanted to do today is talk about how, you know, we titled the talk Bringing Your Personal and Professional Values Out into Your Work and into Your World and How Your Life Reflects Them. And so I wanna go there. I think that ecology, this is a great audience for this. My great spiritual and world awakenings happened in college when I started studying ecology. So to me, ecology is one of the paths into the profound mysteries of life, which all sacred paths, be they sacred path of quantum physics, religion, ecology, all come to the same conclusion that all things are interconnected. So that's not a casual comment, it's a real comment. You know that from ecology. You cannot do something without a ripple going out into a million other things and bouncing back in ways we don't understand. And we keep trying to understand. We have 55,000 pesticides in the environment at the moment, and there's never been any serious work on how they operate in conjunction. There's been some work on some of them. I used to do FDA work. There's been some work on some of them, on how they individually operate in the human body and in the ecosystem, but not a lot. But there's not been a lot of work on how they interconnect, how they work together, the synergies between them. And that's devastating. There's 55,000, and every month there's more coming out. So we have to recognize very deeply and profoundly the interconnectedness of all things, not just from a spiritual point of view, but how do we manifest that? How do we make that a foundational principle in how we go out into the world? So the question is, you know, especially when the ecological web is so obvious in the tropics, how do we take this insight and how do we translate that into action that both represents our values and also can have a positive impact on the planet or on the ecosystems that we choose to work with? Someone came up to me at one of these talks, because I kind of give them now and then, and said, gee, I really like what you do. I want to have a values-based business. I was talking to a business crowd. And she said, how do you make a values-based business? And it struck me, I said, well, the truth is, every business is a values-based business. The question is, are you expressing the values that you truly hold? Because most businesses are not really a reflection of the deepest held values of the owners. If you talk to them one-on-one, they sort of take on a life of their own. And if you allow any venture or endeavor you're engaged in to go on and you're not thinking about where it's going, there will come a time where your values are betrayed by your own actions. Happens all the time. So the first thing to know is that all businesses, all endeavors are values-based. There is no such thing as a value-neutral system. A computer is not a value-neutral system. A pencil is not a value-neutral system. Any government program, any ecological program that we create as humans comes with that set of values that we or the organization or the group of people bring into it. There is no such thing as a values-neutral or a values-free system. So the issue is recognize the values and then come up and say, wow, are these the true values that I hold? And some of that's going to come out as I get into more what Dean's means is how I've tried to reflect my values. And one of the underlying philosophies of Dean's Beans is that we are a process. We are an eternal process. So no matter what we think is a way of doing business that's appropriate, if something comes back to us that says, there's something missing here, instead of covering it up or making phony press announcements or misleading statements like many companies right here in New England do all the time about their business practices, I'm not going to mention them because I do that and then people get upset, but you can go out and find them, just keep a discerning eye on advertising. Rather than hide and protect ourselves from that, we welcome that as an opportunity to go deeper, to go deeper. And that, to me, is what, you know, what our goal is at Dean's Beans, is to constantly go deeper. So since everybody comes up with fancy names and trademarks and, you know, you can't go to a yoga class without it being, you know, the Stretch L Elevation of Love Yoga TM. You know, you can't do anything anymore without seeing the TM or the orange circle. Since that's the way life seems to be these days, I'll give you mine, okay? I call this deep commerce. Haven't trademarked it, probably won't, but to me it's a combination of being involved in business activity, but doing it in an intentional way and a constantly investigative way that brings us constantly to deeper and deeper levels. And we've been burned on some of the stuff we've done because we didn't know enough about what we were doing, and we just learn from it, be humble about it, and move on and try to do better. Because how do we react? How do we react to the revelations that come to us when we're doing these things? Well, we have several ways. We can be defensive, and as I just described, a lot of businesses are, rather than simply face up and say, oops, we made a mistake, you know, yes, I did that with the intern. Yes, we actually did put pesticides on our organic product. Oops, we sold 95% of our rainforest nuts in our rainforest product. Didn't really come from the cooperative that we say we came from, but you know, we couldn't find any more. So instead of telling you the truth and saying what a successful project, they can't even fill our needs and we went elsewhere, we simply lied, didn't tell anybody, and sold all these horrible nuts and sorry, you know, when we got caught and appeared on the Boston Herald, Boston Globe. I'm not gonna mention Ben and Jerry's because saying names doesn't seem to really help. So your choice is to be defensive about it or, as I said, go deeper. And how do you go deeper? Well, you set the intention to go deeper. You say, or I say, when something comes up that doesn't work, gotta dig deep. You know, the thing about coffee that's such a wonderful area for me to work in is coffee, like most commerce, involves layers and layers of middlemen and layers of information and layers of illusion between me and my coffee cup and the life of the farmer. Okay? People in coffee treat farmers in a horrible, horrible, disrespectful fashion. Not because the people in coffee, and this is where it gets hard to talk sometimes to organizations, not because coffee people, the people in New England Coffee, Green Mountain, whatever, not because they're nasty, horrible people, although some of them can be, but largely because they don't have the information and don't have the mindset about what's going on here. People here in New England pride themselves on community, they pride themselves on neighborliness, and yet the people in the coffee industry in New England, by and large, don't treat the people at the other end of the spectrum, people at the other end of the spectrum, people in New England don't treat people in the tropical end of the spectrum with the same respect and care as they treat their neighbor. And we try to bust through that and say, there's no difference between a person 6,000 miles away who's providing me with a product and we touch each other's hand than there is from a person who lives next door and might be helping me on a project. Are we really partners? Are we really neighbors? Are we really in community? Or are those words marketing and advertising? And that's a serious challenge because it's very, very easy to treat these people as if they're not people. Business tends to commodify humans, and what we're trying to do is humanize the commodity, to bring back the human face, to bring back the direct connection into our commodity relationships. And as I said, what do you know? We're still profitable, even though most business people will say, you can't do that and be profitable. can't treat people like this with respect, you can't give them fair pay, you can't help them in their community projects, because it'll impact our profit too much, we won't be profitable. And since that was sort of the shibboleth, since that was sort of the mantra of business, that's what we took on and challenged. And we found it, as with most mantras, to be, you know, somewhat incorrect and dated. You can't really know the karmic aftermaths of your actions. And that's why I think people get very defensive when we challenge them about their business practices in the tropics. Because, you know, karma will tell you, quantum physics will tell you, neural pathway analysis will tell you, when you release energy, when you do an action, you can't know what's going to happen as a result of it. And as a result of it, many times bad things happen from good intentions. And when that happens, again, the choice is, what are you going to do? So in our lives, I can take a credit card out of my wallet. I can take my wedding ring, which I don't wear today because I was working yesterday and it got kind of sore, banging nails. Or I can take my coffee cup. Those three daily objects I can take and show how an act of love or an act of friendship can turn into a horribly disastrous ecological and social act. That wedding ring, which I bought for my wife and my wife bought for me as an act of love, probably came from a mine which used cyanide to leach out the gold from solution, leaving billions of gallons of cyanidated wastewater in the groundwater. I know because I fought that mine for 10 years in Montana on behalf of the Fort Belknap Reservation. That mine, over 10 years, even though it was the world's largest cyanide heap leach mine, never had a single environmental impact statement. Because of the way that the government, the federal and state governments, got together and created a program where the feds devolved responsibility to the state, and the state wasn't interested. So you couldn't go after the feds because the feds said, well, the state has it. You couldn't go after the state because, frankly, they didn't care. They were more interested in the jobs, and they were more interested in the revenue they were getting, both under the table and over the table. So here's my act of love with my wife, wreaking havoc on the environment and on the indigenous communities that I care about. Well, I don't know that. I don't know where that ring came from, but that's where it can be. My credit card, my wonderful credit card, and I used to carry this Citibank credit card, my wonderful credit card, which allows me to buy things and go on these trips and do my good work, my credit card is owned by Citibank, which is the largest funder of Mitsubishi's destructive forestation program in the South Pacific. The island nations of, in Vanuatu, Palau, all these islands, the Kalimantan Peninsula, all these islands in Borneo, these areas are being terribly, terribly destroyed by Mitsubishi's forestry practice. Or lack of forestry practice, I should say. And yet, the funding for that largely comes from Citibank. The funds for Citibank largely come from the fees from Dean Saikhan's credit card. The problem with bringing this up to people is, generally, people are good people and they want to do good things. So if they're challenged with that, they get defensive. So the question is, do you attack people for their behaviors, or do you understand that karmically we're all involved in this thing and go at it a little more gently? I've kind of changed my attitude over the years from the attack mode to a more analytical and understanding mode. And frankly, I think we've gotten a few more flies with the honey than we have with the vinegar. But I think there's people need levels of anger and levels of passion, and how it manifests is kind of up to you. But you can really alienate people with sort of righteous anger. I know, because we just had an incident with my father-in-law last night trying to get him to acknowledge how roughly he treated my brother-in-law, and he instead got very defensive because he felt like he was being attacked and therefore never saw the issue. It's the same thing in business. If you go up and you throw a bucket of red paint or blood on a corporate executive, it's probably not going to get them to open up their eyes and go, oh, I see. It doesn't. You know. On the other hand, you don't let people off easy. But there's a place in there for righteousness and passion and judgment, but there's a place in there also for passion and appropriate strategies for how you bring these things out. And that is a serious part of the work, believe me. Okay. Well, what's at risk? What's at risk for, like, really taking those values and trying to jump in there and change the world with them? What's at risk of taking your ecological knowledge and applying it to your credit card, applying it to your business, applying it to your teaching? What's at risk? Well, for a lot of people, it's simply, this is all too confusing. I don't want to go there. Every time I learn something, I learn that it had yet another impact that, you know, I gave this money to save the children and I thought that was a good thing, and then I find out that, you know, they're using it in ways that if I'd known exactly what was happening, the dynamic in that village that was being shredded culturally by the impact of this aid program, I never would have done it. But how am I going to get that information? It's all so overwhelming. That's how it feels. So one reaction to trying to go deeper is that it's just confusing. But you can reframe that confusion and see it as a challenge to go deeper, a challenge to learn more, not to flog yourself for doing something that was at odds with your values, but actually, okay, man, this is a challenge, and how am I going to react to this? I'm going to react with my highest self, my highest values. I'm going to go deeper. I'm going to do a little more studying before I give money to this organization or that organization. I'm going to ask questions. Okay, one vehicle to do that. It's an opportunity to clarify your own values because, you know, people who go into Starbucks, which is only 3%, 3.5% fair trade at this point, some people say, well, look at all the fair trade they do. I feel good about that. And yet other people go and say, wow, what about the 97% of the other farmers that don't get that kind of treatment? Why do I want to support that? You know, so you've got to dig deeper and plunge and find your own comfort level with all of these issues. But it's an opportunity to clarify your values. It's too time consuming. Yes, it is. The people who are destroying this world do it 9 to 5. The people who are trying to change this world, by and large, finish their 9 to 5, and then they have to go do more work on the nights and on the weekends to organize, to read, to understand, to participate. And it's hard. Social change is really hard. There's not a lot of people making a good living off social change. It's mostly people doing it in their spare time, after they put their kids to bed, after they've paid the bills, after they've worked a hard day. So, yeah, social change is hard, and it's a lot easier to walk away from and say it's too time consuming. Listen, I'll get to it when my kids go to college. I hear that a lot. I say it a lot. The other big risk is the risk of failure. A lot of people get involved and get burned out in social change. And you could take what I'm saying, social change, and say ecological awareness, ecological work. It is the same thing. It's really profound social change. I'll fail again. I tried that. I worked with this community group, and we got shot down. You know, we tried this project in Zaire, and, you know, the villagers came and cut down the trees we planted. I throw my arms up, okay? People do that. But falling off the path is the path. Failing and learning from failure and getting back on the path, that is the path. Nobody I've ever met has ever been 100% successful in every endeavor in social change or any kind of awareness work that they do. You fail time and time again, but the Indonesians have, the Javanese particularly, have this incredible saying, which has been with me for many, many years. And that is what you do, Arjuna. You add your light to the sum of lights. It's not your role to be the final arbiter of what happens, but you can add your light to the sum of lights. Stay on the good side, be part of the force that's working in this direction. Yeah, we fail, yeah, we do wrong things, but our intention is good, and we're learning as we go, and we work well. And this is why this world hasn't been destroyed already. Because if you read the newspapers and you only limit yourself to what goes on in the public realm, you have to be depressed. You have to be depressed. But at the same time, if you say, well, wait a minute, if all these destructive forces are out there and all this greed and all this corruption is out there, how the heck have we survived this far? How have we survived this far? That's where going deeper helps. And that's where when I plunged deep into working in the nonprofit and the activism world, I found out that underneath the surface of public media is a network of tens of thousands of organizations all over the world. And they're working together, working individually, but working intentionally and karmically together to bring light into the world, to do the right thing, to save their community, to save their water source, to stop that road, to inhibit that deforestation. And you don't see it as a movement, although there are attempts to make it a movement, global social movement, for example. But really, it's just happening in small places all over the world. And that is the counterbalance. That's why we're not in a darker period than we are. And that's why there's always hope, is because this room is full of people who care. You know, Antioch is churning out graduates who care. I've been churning it out, that's okay. Judgment, not that kind of institution. But, you know, people are graduating every day, people are working every day, and a lot of change is happening. And it's positive change. And if you focus on what's going on in the world of the magazines and the newspaper and the politicians, you'll be in such despair you'll walk away. But the challenge is to go deeper and see what's really happening. There is a balance. There's an eternal balance going on, and we're really participating in keeping that light side up. So let me jump into some of the ways that Dean's being, so I know I'm kind of like the bride at a wedding. You can't start without me, you can't stop without me, so I'm just going to keep going. Let me just talk about some of the specific ways that Dean's Beans manifests the things that we're talking about. As Peter mentioned, we work only in organics. And that doesn't mean we just find organic farms. We work in organic training. We're bringing over a gentleman named John Jiroge from Kenya, who has this organization, a little organization called Kenyan Institute of Organic Farming. It's the only institute of organic farming in Kenya. Well, we're paying for John Jiroge to come here and get training as an organic inspector. He's so far beyond organic inspectors, it's unbelievable, but he needs the credential. We've made an arrangement with QAI, Quality Assurance International, the largest organic inspectors, that if John gets, John's 50, you know, if John gets his certificate, that QAI will use him as an inspector in Kenya. And that way we can start building infrastructure and start building capacity at KEOF for KEOF to become the organic certification entity in Kenya, with the goal, ultimately, that KEOF builds up and they become recognized as an NOP certified organic entity in competition, in a sense, with the QAIs and the OCIAs and the Naturlands of the world. We're trying to build that capacity. So for us, it's not just about buying organic coffee and saying, aren't we great? It's going deeper and making sure that mission of organics keeps going and going in the right direction. People ask me to run for the organic board, you know, and on the national level, and it's like, I don't do boards, I just can't, I get angry, it's not the best use of my time. That's why I'm not a lawyer anymore. I can't stand lawyers, I can't stand being on boards. Every board I've ever been on, I've had to leave because I don't do anything except get angry. So, and I can't control my temper very well. So anyway, so, you know, go where your energy is the best, right? I thought law was the avenue for social change, and I found out it is a great avenue for social change, just not for me. I don't have the constitution, if you pardon the pun, to be a lawyer involved in social change, so I found this other venue for my skills and my passion. So that's how we're working with organics, helping to create infrastructure. Similarly, I was in Papua New Guinea last November, organizing cooperatives, helping farmers understand the value of cooperative organization, the value of organic certification, the value of fair trade certification. And I'm proud to report that not even a year later, several of the groups I work with have formed legal cooperatives. They've gotten their organic certification through Australia Organic, and they've gotten they've been inspected for the Fair Trade Registry and should be on very shortly. It will triple the income of those farmers, triple it. And they, when I was over there, they're like, oh, triple the income, what a flim-flam man, you know, I'm trying to sell them vinyl siding when they have grass huts. But no, I said, you know, let's just wait and see. I'm not selling you anything. In fact, I will be buying from you at a higher price. So that's the kind of work we do in advocacy for organics. The organic system, for those who don't know about this, in coffee, obviously it's not organic by neglect. And I know that a lot of people here understand this, but let me just go through it quickly. Organics in coffee is pretty much a 2 or 3 year program of training and monitoring for farm groups. It requires farmers to really understand the need for recycling waste products and mulching and composting. It requires appropriate terracing for slopes. It requires shade. It requires an understanding of water flow for the purpose of saving water and inhibiting waste going into streams. because coffee cherry is the cherry on the plant.
Oh, we've got a little cherry right there.
The coffee cherry, which surrounds the coffee bean, is quite toxic to fish and wildlife. Not toxic to us, people make wine out of it. But if it gets into a water course, it can be toxic. And I've seen algae blooms, I've seen fish kills, I've seen a mess from improper disposal of coffee waste. So teaching farmers about the importance of sequestering that waste into the compost and mulch stream is a very, very important part of organics. Anyway, so it's quite a complex and demanding system. And I'm really proud that we're 100% organic and have been since day one. We use organics and ecology as our philosophy for growth, too, on this side. And this is something you'll never hear from anybody else, so wake up if I put you to sleep. We use the philosophy and the principles of ecology on our business. People, plants, human organization, animal and insect organization, there's not a lot of difference, a lot of similar principles. So the ordinary business, the mainstream business, says we need to grow 20% this year in order to what? Build another plant, knock out the competition, increase our area of influence, blah, blah, blah. And how are we going to get there? We're going to close down that plant. We're going to cut down the pension of those workers. We're going to fire 50% of our workforce. We're going to outsource our product. It really messes up communities. That's the mainstream model of growth. We at Beans Beans have a very different model. We don't advertise. We do a little underwriting on public radio, but that's because I want to support public radio. We don't advertise. We don't have a sales and marketing staff. We don't. We don't cold call people. We don't. We grow by word of mouth, because we grow under the belief that the community of people that is trying Beans Beans and hearing about us, learning about us, is going to grow and is going to spread, and they'll be real supporters, and they'll share that information with other people, and I believe in that system, and it's worked. We've grown on an average of 24% every year for the last 6 years, and we're on the same track this year. It's just happening. So our ecological model, just like if the tree gets too big, what happens? It grows its story, it will kill everything that's underneath it. Killing everything that's underneath it weakens the soil structure, weakens the interconnection of things in the soil, which ultimately weakens the roots, which ultimately means that when the wind blows, the tree falls over. So was it such a smart idea to get so big, so fast? No, but the tree did it. So even in ecology, there can be logical mistakes. So what we use at Dean's Beans in recognition of that is we don't want to grow too fast. We grow when our resources and the community resources that support us indicate growth, and then growth happens ecologically. It doesn't happen on a plan, it happens ecologically. And in that way, we believe our growth is sustainable because it's not forced. It happens because the community welcomes it. Or that's how we interpret it, the community, our community of resources and people from the farmers on to our customers welcome it in a way. So that's our philosophy of growth, and that's how we use organics and ecology sort of to infuse our business. A very important thing, community building is a big piece of today's goals, stated goals. How do we involve ourselves in community building? It's perfectly reasonable for a mainstream company to buy a commodity by walking into a village, the farmer holds out the beans, you pick them up, you say, the world market price is X, I give you X, I'll even give you X plus five. The farmer says, thank you, shake your hand, you walk away, and you get the coffee beans. That's mainstream business. That's even nice mainstream business when I mentioned the plus 5 cents, right? Because you don't have to do that. I could buy all the coffee I want in the world and never pay more than the world market price, which has nothing to do with the cost of production. It's based on speculation in New York and London. It has nothing to do with the cost of production. It's totally an unecological, even in a business sense, way to create a price. What we do is we believe that we are a community. We believe that the folks we work with, that by the way, was a garbage dump out of the side of León, Nicaragua, where people live, because they send, instead of going to school, they send their kids to the garbage dump to bring back stuff to support the families. So I wanted to have that up there. We believe that we are a community. a real community. We take that seriously. We believe we are partners with the coffee farmers. That's not marketing. We take that seriously. And how do you treat a partner? If a partner's in need, you work together to try to address that need. How do we manifest that value? We do what we call people-centered development. It's a development philosophy, and I believe in it. Most development is top-down. It's driven by the agenda and the funding of the organizations that do the aid or charity work. People-centered development spins that on its head. People-centered development starts with the theory, the belief, that the people who live there may not know the best way to get to where they got to get to. I don't want to use the noble savage thing that people in aid sometimes use in response to the hierarchy of aid. But rather, people know what their issues are, and they know within those issues what their priorities are. So my role, and I love doing this, is to go into the villages I work with and sit down with the women's groups, sit down with the farmers, sit down with the school teachers and talk. What are the big issues here? What are the goals? What are the goals of development of this village? What do people want? What would they like to see? Not the actual, we want to see a factory, someone once told me that. We want to see a maquiladora zone. It's like, maybe you don't. But anyway, they want to see employment, they want to see income generation, they want to see clean water, they want to see opportunity for their kids, they want to see schools, they want to see health. Okay, but interestingly enough, in the same village, I might meet with four groups and they'll have four different priorities. It's all within the same range of need or desire, but the priorities are different, and we work with people's identified priorities. We then help strategize on how we can reach those priorities. How can we address those? And so we create projects. We create projects that we fund out of our cash flow, our profit, and Dean's home equity loan, because we're not Starbucks. We don't have that much money. So every now and then, I gotta dig into my home equity loan, lend it to the company, and the company funds the project. But that's my commitment as the owner of the company. The point is, we don't go seek out CARE or Save the Children or any other organization to do this work, and there's a good reason. Example, in Ethiopia, a couple years ago, in 2003, I was the first American fair trader to go to Ethiopia, meet farmers, and come back with organic fair trade coffee. The first organic fair trade coffee in America, we brought it back. And I'm very proud of that, in conjunction with a couple of other small roasters. But I was the first guy to go there. So I was visiting all these villages, and besides the malnutrition, which was obvious, they said, well, what's the biggest issue here? And universally, the villagers said water. We need water. We're desperate for clean, potable, local water sources. So we created a program called Miriam's Well. We used Miriam's Well because Miriam was a biblical prophetess who, everywhere she went in the desert, she found water. Ethiopia is very much Old Testament oriented. That was a good one. They got that. Miriam. So we call it Miriam's Well, and it's a revolving loan fund. We grant $8,000 to cooperatives, and they build the well, pay back the fund, a penny a pound at harvest, then it rotates to the next cooperative, and like Miriam, it keeps finding water in the desert. We're going over next Friday to celebrate our third well. The point of this one, is that when we first started looking at wells, I thought, well, how am I going to get a well built in Ethiopia? The farmers don't have equipment. So I asked the farmers to go find out how they could do it. But when I came back, I said, well, I'll find out too. So I contacted all the groups I could who build wells in the third world. And one organization I was talking to said, oh, well, we can do that because we work in Ethiopia, we work in the Horn of Africa, and we can build a well. It'll be about $40,000. And I said, $40,000 to dig a hole in the ground in Ethiopia? Is that possible? Well, you know, we got to have the consultants coming in, and then we got the administrative overhead of 26%, and then we got the travel, and then we got the per diems, you know, and by the way, you know, then we're going to buy the pipe for a dollar. So I said, there must be a better way. And with the farmers, we worked it out, and it cost $8,000. That's where the $8,000 figure came from. And that was high, but that was because they had to bring equipment from a private company all the way out from Addis, 10 hours. On bad roads to where the farming villages were. And you know, that's just what it costs. And the farmers ran it, the farmers got paid for their labor to build the well, so the money stayed in the community, but that's what it cost. On my trip, going deeper, on this trip, we're gonna meet with the farmers and talk about what would it be like if we helped you buy well building equipment and you could build your own wells for your own communities and charge for it, the actual cost, including labor, so that you actually keep the money in the community, and you can also build wells for private companies, whatever, and get more money in. But how'd you like to have your own well-building business instead of hiring other people to do it? We'll see. That's a big ask. You know, I mean, if someone asked me to be a well-builder, I'd have to say no. But it's the farmer's choice if they want to do that, and we're willing to help them do that. And we're bringing in a New Zealand fair trader who's really excited about this too, and making it probably the first Dean's Beans project where a lot of other people are involved. We generally don't do that because our business model is, it comes from us because this is our relationship. Other examples, we call it reclaiming the sacred in Peru. When I was in Peru last 2 years ago with this small co-op, I helped get their first fair trade sale, and now they sell 90% of the coffee fair trade, so that's another part of the business model. We talked to them about what their big priority was, and in the indigenous areas on the Amazonian slopes in central Peru, they were saying, you know, the settlers came in here under government programs in the late 70s and 80s, and they deforested much of our sacred land, and we'd really like to bring it back. So we created this program called Reclaiming the Sacred, and it's a reforestation program using local hardwoods, local medicine woods that the community decides, and the shamans involved say, okay, what does this ecology look like? How do we recreate our human ecology plant community here, rather than bringing in eucalyptus plantations that suck up the water, or pine that changes the soil, it changes the bird life? How can we recreate what we know is here and what we rely on as a community? So we started this program. We paid for the first 5,000 trees. So interestingly enough, I just got an email yesterday from this cooperative, and they said, we've got really great news. As a result of this program, GDL, Green Development Fund in the Netherlands, they came by, they saw this program, they were so impressed by it, they're giving us the funding to plant an additional 20,000 trees. So they said, the seed that we planted, so to speak, has really grown into something wonderful for that community. And so that's the kind of things we do for people-centered development. And the final tool to talk about is the economic piece, because you can do all the ecological work in the world, but if there's no economy to hold people together, especially under the assault of globalization, communities fracture. So we need to build local economies. The first tool in that toolbox is fair trade. And we use fair trade. We're 100% fair trade. We're not members of Transfair, in case people might know about this. We're members of the Fair Trade Federation, which is only made up of 100% fair trade companies. No posers allowed, no 10%ers, no 3%ers. You gotta be 100% fair trade. That's where the serious players in the fair trade world are. We're proud members of the Fair Trade Federation. Fair trade to us is not just an economic equation that when the price goes down, there's a safety net. That's very important. And when the price goes up, you pay 5 cents more, so you know, to feel good about yourself. I've always been bothered by that, because the way the world market works, the price of coffee goes up and down every week, every day. And what you paid today as a fair trade price, the market the next day may actually go up a little above it. So New England coffee, which is not a fair trade coffee, may on Wednesday actually pay more than I paid on Tuesday, and I'm fair trade. And this was a real problem about a year and a half ago, when all of a sudden the coffee prices shot up. And what happened was, all of these companies, and Green Mountain was one, who had these fixed price fair trade contracts with farmers, all of a sudden the market price shot up past that. And the farmer said, hey, fair trade, we're supposed to get more. And Green Mountain and other companies said, oh, whoa, you signed long-term contracts with us. You're bound by them. And we said, of course we'll rewrite the contract. I don't know if Sylvia's in the audience here, but you know, from forest trade, but they had the same experience. We rewrote the contracts with the farmers. Yes, we had fixed contracts, but the market changed and the farmers could get more, and as fair traders, it was our obligation to always best the market, which we say is unfair. So we rewrote the contracts. A lot of companies did not. They made a lot of money on the farmers when mainstream coffee companies were actually paying more than they were, yet they had the right to call their coffee fair trade. So for me, this economic equation thing is not enough. It's about a relationship. So our fair trade goes deeper. Not only do we pay 6 cents in addition, that's our profit share, 6 cents in addition to the fair trade price. By the way, our minimum fair trade price is $1.50. the transfer minimum price is $1.41 for organics. So we way outclass the standard fair trade. And on top of that, we add 6 cents, which is a profit share. For every pound of Peruvian coffee I sell, we take 6 cents out of that price and stick it in a fund, and we send it back to the villagers at once or twice a year. They can do what they want with it. Some people distribute it because people desperately need money. Some people put it together and buy upstream capacity with it, like a processing plant. Some people put it into swoon loans in Peru. This organization got $5,000 from us, $3,000 for this year. $3,000 they took and started a women's loan fund. The first time ever women in that area had access to credit, ever. And the first woman who took a loan used it to pay tuition to get her son into university, the first kid from this area ever to go to university. So this is powerful stuff. This is partnership. It's not an economic equation. It's not a marketing tool. It's not something you slough off and walk away from. I've done my share. You know, this is a serious commitment, and this is how we take our values and lay them out in our practice. Wow, that's about it. So, in summary, just let me reiterate, you know, find your values, don't give them up, be willing to challenge yourself and learn more about how your values actually play out in the world, and if they come up short of what your true beliefs are, reassess them, don't hold on to them because they're not really you, let them go, move on, learn from it. That's the way the light will be brought into the world, that's the way our ecology will stay healthy and keep us going, and that's the way out of this bind. So, thank you very much for having me. I'm going to stick around for most of the day, and go forth and multiply. You're doing great work. Thanks.